Kirsten Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
You know what today is, Marjorie?
Yes, I do, Jim. It's Friday.
Well, that was my... It's 3 days. 3 days counting from April 1st when everything changes.
Oh, really?
It does. April 1st.
April 1st?
It's huge. That's it.
Do you know what has happened every April 1st for as long as I've known you, Jim?
No. Oh, actually, I do.
I say, okay. Jim, okay. You got a hole in your shirt.
Okay.
Jim,
it's rather childish,
you cut your face.
Marjorie.
This has been going on for like 17 years.
It has.
And for 17 years, what does Jim do? He runs to the bathroom to check off the cut in his face.
Sorry I brought it up.
I got a good one planned for this year, Jim.
Can't wait. So today, Marjorie, the Centers for Disease Control released a second batch of graphic anti-smoking ads. They're obviously intended to scare thousands into becoming smoke-free. They are, obviously, everybody knows, controversial, including in this studio. Here's one of them.
Smoking gave me COPD, which makes it harder and harder for me to breathe. I have a tip for you. If your doctor gives you 5 years to live, spend it talking with your grandchildren. Explain to them that your grandpa's not going to be around anymore to share his wisdom and his love. I haven't figured out how to do that yet. I'm running out of time.
We want to know if you think the CDC got it exactly right or if they're going too far. You can give us a buzz at 877-301-8970. We'll play more for you in a minute. But first, joining us to sort through the campaign is Deborah Kotz. She writes a Daily Dose blog for Boston.com, is a health reporter for The Globe, and she's on the line from Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us, Deborah.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Deborah, the government put out the second round of these really graphic and some would say gruesome ads on Thursday. This is obviously the second round. What happened with the first round? Did they work?
Well, yeah. The CDC director said that according to their statistics, they really did work. I mean, they had about a big increase in the number of calls to the quit line. They had about 200,000 extra people last year called those quit lines while they were running the ads. And research suggests that about 20% of the people who call those quit lines will wind up quitting smoking for good.
Deborah, I'm a big advocate of these things. Marjorie, not so much so. But reading your piece, you're in the skeptical category. And after these numbers you just recited, why are you a skeptic?
Well, you know, I'm skeptical because I think that it sort of categorizes all smokers into one group. The group that basically they enjoy smoking very much and, you know, they've thought about quitting, but they don't really have a strong incentive to quit. So that if they see an ad that really scares them, that will finally get them on the road to quitting. I don't think it gives enough weight to the fact that smoking is a serious addiction, on par, actually. You know, it's actually considered to be more addictive than alcohol, more addictive than heroin, on par even with like coke and methamphetamine. And it really takes a lot of effort for some people to quit. It's not just a matter of scaring them,
you know,
but really providing them.
Yeah. Thank you, Deborah. Jim over here has never smoked, so he has no idea what he's talking about.
I smoked actually one cigarette in the Catskills
really
when
hard.
I was a kid.
By the way, if people have seen these ads and you want to weigh in on whether you like them, think they're effective, think we should be spending all this money on these ads, we'd love to hear from you. Our numbers are 877-301-8970. Deborah, thank you for pointing out how addictive cigarette smoking is. And you also have something that stunned me in your story about physicians that deal with lung cancer patients, that 80% of specialists in lung cancer, dealing with lung cancer, reported in this survey, almost half of them have no idea how to advise people how to quit smoking. I found that shocking. I mean, maybe you wouldn't need to have these horrible ads if your physician, who's a specialist in lung cancer, could say to you, this is what you do, these are the prescriptions you can get, these are the programs you can join. What is wrong with these doctors?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of them are skeptical. First of all, they're skeptical. I mean, 80% of these doctors say that they do talk to their patients about quitting. But yeah, you know, 40% of them don't do anything to actually help them quit. So, you know, it's not enough to just say to a patient, hey, you need to quit smoking. You know, I think that by the time many of them get to lung cancer, they realize they have regrets and they probably would like to quit, but there are quite a few number of people who just can't quit on their own that easily. I mean, some people probably can. You know, I have never been a smoker, so I don't understand the full effects of it, but I think that, you know, some people probably can quit easily, but there's probably a larger proportion of people who really have a tough time.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Even if you haven't seen this brand new round of ads, everybody saw those graphic photographs on the packs that were in round one, modeled on what happened in Canada. You know, Deborah Kotz, the CDC fact release that went out from their newsroom said almost 90% of smokers started before they were 18. Many of them experienced life-changing health effects at a relatively early age. The place where I have to admit that I am borderline skeptical is when you're a kid and you think you're totally invincible. Do you get scared straight when you see somebody who doesn't have a larynx anymore, as in one of these ads, or this guy who spoke a minute ago who's crying, saying he's never going to see his grandchildren? Do kids react to these things, or is it mostly adults who are scared out of smoking?
Well, you know, I think for prevention, in my mind, I think that for prevention, it may actually have more of an impact because, you know, if somebody tells you that this thing is really going to kill you and they show you a pretty gruesome image of something, you may be a little less likely to start something because it's a lot easier to not do something that you've never done before than to stop doing something that has really become an addiction. So, you know, and I was even asking the CDC director this on the phone line, can this be used for prevention? And he said, you know, we're not going to run these ads on kids' TV stations, but we certainly have a lot of kids who are in these movie theaters watching these movies, and they may see these ads, and we're hoping that it is good for prevention. But you're right. I mean, you know, a lot of teens do think they're invincible. You know, we talk to them about drinking and driving. We talk to them about, you know, using contraception. We talk to them a lot of these health risks, and we hope that some of it's penetrating. And, I mean, the good news is there are fewer teen smokers than there were in the past. They would like it to decline further because the biggest group of people who are starting smoking are teen girls, and that's been a problem for a long time. And I don't think they've been able to quite crack that one. So it's, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done.
We're talking with Deborah Kotz from the Boston Globe, who wrote a great piece about the advertisements designed to help people quit smoking and about the problems with quitting smoking. Last question from me, Deborah. You also made a great point in your piece about the genetic predisposition of some people to smoke like a furnace. I mean, it is really true. You can see it in families where some people, they get out of bed in the morning, they have a cup of coffee, they got a cigarette in their mouth, the first thing going. And some people are the so-called social smokers who can manage to, you know, the only time they smoke is if they, when you used to be able to go to a bar room and smoke in a bar room. There is a genetic predisposition.
Absolutely, which is really interesting. And I think there's a genetic predisposition for a lot of addictions. But yeah, this article, which got almost no attention, came out this week in one of the JAMA journals and found that there are specific gene mutations that predispose kids as teenagers. You know, when they start to smoke, when all their peers are smoking, some of those teens will go on to become very heavy smokers, will go on to smoke to control stress levels, and will go on to find that it's much harder for them to quit, and that is due to these genetic mutations. So, at this point, they're not able to take that research and really find a treatment based on that, but I think that's really useful information that should guide researchers and say, you know what, maybe we need to have these personalized quitting programs for people, figure out, you know, why it is they're smoking, why it is hard for them to quit. You know, one reader wrote in that hypnosis really helped for her to finally quit over the years. You know, others may have more help with these prescription antidepressants. Some people may do fine with a nicotine patch, but it's very individualized what will work for you. And, you know, even quitting with a friend can help. But again, like, you don't want to oversimplify and say that one size fits all. It's just not the case with smoking.
Deborah Kotz, she writes a Daily Dose blog for Boston.com, health reporter for the Globe. Deborah, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You know, when Deborah mentioned the hypnosis, what's the name of the guy in Brookline?
The Russian guy. I don't know. I went to him when I used to smoke. It didn't work.
People say it's an incredibly high success rate.
It didn't work for me.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Before you express that thought, can we play one more example? One more of the ads from the CDC. Round two, very graphic release today, and then we'll get to your calls.
If you're a smoker, I have a tip for you. Make a video of yourself before all this happens. Read a children's storybook or sing a lullaby. I wish I had. The only voice my grandson's ever heard is this one.
You can quit. For free help, visit cdc.gov/tips.
I know everybody, it makes a lot of people cringe. That's a woman with a voice box, but I am sorry.
Not just a voice box.
When you hear that, Marjorie.
She puts in false teeth, a full set of false teeth. She puts on a wig.
I don't know. Think that's going to affect anybody?
I think it's a devastating ad. Your heart goes out to this woman. But I just want to say one thing, because you are so holier than thou about this.
On this issue, I am,
as someone who has never smoked,
one
who has no idea what he's talking about, you treat smokers like they're child molesters or like lepers or something like that. I think you should have the same empathy for smokers as you would have for an alcoholic who's trying to stop drinking or for a heroin addict.
Where's the lack of empathy? I'm just saying it's a horrible thing.
You have no empathy.
440,000 Americans each year, according to the CDC.
Yeah.
You do whatever you got to do.
Well, you know, obesity is a big deal, too. And you hold your nose about the smell from smoking, like these people are just going to smoke because they want to smoke. You start because you may want to, or you may want to look cool. You may want to be grown up. It's an addiction. Have a little heart there.
I do. 877-301-8970. What do you think of these really graphic ads? And I'm glad Deborah said this. It's not just on TV and the newspaper. They're trailers or whatever you want to call
theaters.
Them, shorts and movie theaters. So kids
How
will see them.
How great is that? You're in there with your buttered popcorn and all of a sudden you see this ad on the screen.
You hits you right
die.
In the face. Let's go to Tony in Boston. You're first on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. I think Marjorie and Deborah are way off on this. You're missing the key point. The point of these ads is not to solve the problem, because as both of you were saying, it's not one size fits all, but it is one step first. And that one first step is you got to shock someone to saying, wow, I have to quit. I have to do something. Then they start calling around. And yes, that's where the training has to come in, where the healthcare workers have to be prepared to help people in the different ways they need to be helped. But this is not when you're talking about these ads, it's a marketing issue. And if you can create an ad that has you guys talking about it, it means people are noticing about them.
That's
true. And Deborah said 200,000 more people are calling the quit line. You couldn't have a better documentation that these ads are successful. They're getting smokers to take the first step.
Tony, you said it
to the healthcare workers.
You said it far better than I. Tony from Boston, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Tony, I'm not upset about the ads. I'm upset about the nonchalance with which people who've never smoked are lecturing everybody about smoking.
But in all seriousness, Marjorie, there's no lecturing part of this at all.
What are you talking about?
No, I happen to believe in. You don't support Tom Menino. There was an article this morning.
Who do you think is more deviant, Jim? Child molesters or cigarette smokers?
There was an article in the Globe today about how he was on the front lines early on things like gay marriage and smoking bans. Are you against what Tom Menino did, which spread across Massachusetts and the country?
I'm just against with your holier-than-thou attitude. You don't have that holier-than-thou attitude about weight loss, Jim, and you have some considerable experience with that, don't you?
I do, because I like a good hot dog. What can I? I'm a little bit of a hypocrite.
Or 5 or 10.
Let's go to Beverly, where Greg is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Greg.
Hey, guys. I'm 23 years old, and I've been smoking since I was 13, and possibly younger, because my dad, when we'd go on long road trips, he'd roll up the windows when it started raining and chain smoke the whole way.
Oh, Greg.
And those commercials, smokers, we have enough problems, you know. We have to go outside, out front of the building. Everybody stares at us like we're animals behind a window. Like, oh, look at those smokers. They're horrible people.
Exactly.
And those things just like bad people. They don't motivate us to quit. Our coping mechanism is, I need another cigarette right now.
Yeah, but Greg, the research suggests otherwise. As Deborah said a couple of minutes ago, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, close to 250,000 people called the quit line as a result, and 20% of them, that's 40,000 people, quit. So it may not work for you, because as Deborah said, it's not one size fits all. But if it works for somebody, there's no damage, there's no downside to trying this campaign other than spending some money, right?
Well, the thing is, people are getting better at quitting. You know, I quit three times this year already.
Well, obviously you're not very good at quitting if you quit three times this year, Greg. Greg, I'm only kidding. Good luck. I hope it's a fourth, and I hope it lasts for good. Thanks, Greg.
But I also think that's very typical that you try to quit several times before you actually quit.
Do you agree, other than the
money? Getting pregnant is a good way to quit smoking. No,
in all seriousness, other than the money part of this, you agree, even though you're not crazy, there's no downside to doing this. If this gets a low-hanging fruit of smokers.
I don't know if we need them in movie theaters. I don't, you're a captive audience, so you've paid your money, you're eating all your popcorn, you're eating your Reese's peanut butter cups, and you have this huge picture on the screen. I'm not clear that we have to
Perfect
have them in movie
place.
Theaters. And I'm not clear either that we have to have them on cigarette packs. Because if you're an ardent smoker, you're just going to cover up that cigarette pack anyway. There's something kind of, it's almost like punitive and nasty in a way about having a person buy a pack of cigarettes with this black lung on the side of the pack of cigarettes. I think smokers know what they're doing to themselves. It's treating them with contempt.
No,
and
first of all,
I don't like.
Intellectually they know, emotionally they may not, and I think this addresses the emotion.
Emotionally, you know what you're doing, Jim.
Reed, you're in Hudson, New Hampshire. You're on with Jim and Marjorie. We're talking about the new graphic anti-smoking ads released today. Hey, Reed.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Hammer.
Hi.
Hey, how are you? I read.
Years ago, these had Yul Brynner and Joseph Cotten.
Oh,
right,
yes.
Right, right.
Doing a public service ad, and it was, you know, if you see this ad, it's because I died of lung cancer. Don't smoke. I was still smoking at the time. I thought of it, but it didn't make me not smoke. It made me think about it, but not smoke. I mean, eventually I quit because I just thought it was too expensive. But, I hope it'll have an effect. But then again, maybe it's not. If you're a smoker, you're a smoker. And that's what you do.
But, Reed, you even said yourself it made you think twice, and maybe the impact wasn't immediate, but maybe it, you know, was part of your decision-making when you decided ultimately not to do it. And, by the way, for those too young to not say, who are Yul Brynner and Joseph Cotten? Two great actors.
He was in The King and
I. The King and I, right from
can
his...
Can you sing us a few bars
I could not.
From The King and I, Jim?
Reed, thank you. We appreciate your call. Let's go to Brookline. We were talking about the famous guy in Brookline who allegedly has almost a foolproof anti-smoking, stop-smoking campaign. Let's go to Paul. Hey, Paul, you're on with Jim and Marjorie.
I'm actually in Milton, but it sorry.
Pop.
That's okay. First of all, if Greg gets pregnant, he's going to have a lot more to worry about.
Well, that's true. Paul, did you go to the smoking zone? I went to him.
No,
it didn't work.
But in my previous incarnation as a producer, we had Shubentsov on.
Oh, that's the name of the doctor. That's of course,
yes.
Yeah. And what was he like? What was your impression of the guy?
It was with the Jerry Williams program.
Sure.
Yeah. He was very Russian. And I, the very strangest thing, because I don't smoke, I never smoke. I was in the control room, which is like most studios, separated by two thick glass screens. And I was busy at my control desk, and all of a sudden I felt this blast of heat coming through both panes of glass.
Oh, my gosh.
Shubentsov had his hands up, and I was getting a blast of heat through the glass from Shubentsov. Oh, this is 30 years ago. And I can still remember, he's a very, I don't know if you ever went to him, but he was a very intimidating person.
Paul, were you wearing your aluminum hat at that particular time, or were you not?
I didn't see any black helicopters there either, you know, but, I mean, there were enough crazies in that studio to begin with, but...
No, but Paul, in all seriousness, I have spoken to, and I know Marjorie has too, a ton of people. I know, but in addition to you, a ton of people... Overwhelmingly, people say it helped, and in fact, helped them stop.
But I think I think the thing is, Paul, with the hypnotist, you have to really want to quit, and you do feel a little differently before you take your next cigarette. But once you take the next cigarette, your spell is sort of broken, which is tragic.
We're going to squeeze one last quick one. And Joanne, you're in JP, Jamaica Plain. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I am a former smoker. I'm also a public health practitioner, so that's a good oxymoron.
How'd you quit, Joanne?
I was in a public health class at one of the universities here, and my professor in epidemiology did a full 3 hours on the evils of smoking and definitely felt the social pressure and didn't smoke after that point. He actually later told me that he had been a former smoker as well. And so his... glad that I had quit based on his lecture. I think, though, I was in pre-contemplation already, and so it wasn't necessarily just the lecture about the evils of smoking that worked, but my process that I'd already been in. I really fear that these ads just do more to demonize smokers. I think any health issue that we have, whether it's obesity, whether it's drug use, alcoholism,
smoking. There's a lot of shame attached to those issues.
Joanne, you're speaking to the choir here. I am so with you. And when you mentioned the social pressure, I think there is a lot of social pressure now on younger people that there didn't used to be. That, you know, it smells bad, your hair smells bad, your clothes smell bad, you're going to get wrinkles, all these other things. And you see, at least in some towns, fewer kids starting than you did certainly when I was a kid.
Joanne, thanks for calling, though. We really, really appreciate it.
Hear what you said?
Yeah, I did hear what you said.
You're demonizing these people, too.
No, she is.
You're demonizing them.
And she's in the field, so there's obviously some legitimacy there.
Okay, coming up, WGBH's Callie Crossley is going to talk with us about President Obama's attempts to shame lawmakers into action on guns. We'll have that in a minute. Stay with us at 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Listen to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Newtown happened, as you know, on December 14th. Yesterday, President Obama, who was standing with Newtown victims' families, called for passage of gun legislation yet again.
I want to make sure every American is listening today. Less than 100 days ago that happened. And the entire country was shocked. And the entire country pledged we would do something about it, and this time would be different. Shame on us if we've forgotten. I haven't forgotten those kids. Shame on us if we've forgotten.
Joining us to discuss where we are or are not on gun control is our colleague here on GBH. She's the Callie Crossley in Sunday Nights at 6:30 Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Hey, Callie.
Hey, Jim.
So Barack Obama, I guess, did a call yet again yesterday, as virtually nothing except one Senate committee has done anything on gun control. Is this kaput?
It is, and I think it's so sad and pathetic. I think there's, you know, I mean, much has been said about the group of wusses down there who represent people. But the fact that none of them would stand up and put their name, you know, on a piece of legislation saying no or yes, about the strongest thing I've heard in terms of people standing where they're going to stand is from Mark Pryor, who responded to the criticism of his not being able to or deciding not to support the legislation that you don't. I represent Arkansans and don't tell me, you know, what the rest of the country is doing. That's what I'm doing. So at least he made his statement about why he's not going to support it. But everybody else is just hiding.
Yeah, but when you say hiding, can I say the problem we have, I think, is this. And I am obviously on the gun control side, whether it's the magazines or the universal background checks or the assault weapons ban that part of the president's deal, not to mention these straw purchase things, which we can talk about in a minute. What arguments that people, pro-gun control people, used in the weeks after Newtown is the American public wants this overwhelmingly.
That's
well, the
right.
Sad news is there are two polls out this week that show support for gun control. CBS poll 2 days ago, down from 57% right after Newtown to 47%. So, you know, if we're going to live by the sword polling, we're going to die by the sword, too. No, the American people have a short attention span, and sadly, they've moved on.
Well, I don't know that everybody's moved on. I mean, I have a thing about polls anyway, so I should put that aside. My bias about polls as we go along. But I think that given where everybody was, and to your point about what everybody said, and the looking in the faces of those kids, those families and those kids, if we can't remember where we were then, I mean, it's very sad. And something has to happen more than has happened. And if we couldn't even, right now, we don't even have very strong background checks up.
No.
I mean, there's nothing. I mean, there's really nothing. It's disgusting.
And what's amazing, it's amazing. I had never been to one of these gun shows, but a couple of months ago, I went up to New Hampshire, and there's all these rules for Massachusetts residents, which are much stricter, obviously, than New Hampshire residents. But the thing is, you can go up there as a Massachusetts resident, which obviously I am, and buy basically whatever you want, from the private dealers. They're not asking you for your driver's license. They're not asking you who you are. A guy even made a joke to me when I wanted to buy an illegal magazine and said, hey, you know what? This is the United States of America. Buy the magazine. Just don't get pulled over when you drive back into Massachusetts. They're just flaunting all the laws. It's incredible.
Oh, it really is. And I really did think, you know, because I'm Pollyanna on some of these things, that really some of this would get through. So I think, you know, there's two things.
You mean once there were 20 dead kids you're talking about?
Yeah, once there were 20 dead kids. And there's President Obama standing with, you know, mothers who've lost their children to gun violence. And on the heels of this new report about Adam Lanza,
oh,
who was the shooter, with, you know, he's had a whole, police station full of assault
in
weapons.
His bedroom. In his bedroom. And you wonder, what was his mother thinking? His mother had to know
I don't
he
know.
Had some issues, and yet...
She knew she had issues. Did she know that he had that stuff? I don't know.
Well, she gave him a gift certificate to buy a gun for his birthday. I mean, this is a little odd. But you see, that's one of the problems, I think, when you get into the whole mental health issue here, because there are such, as there should be, very strict rules protecting the privacy of patients that are undergoing mental health care. So that's a tough one.
Yeah, but we didn't even put it on the table to try to negotiate where we could keep those lines to protect people's privacy or not. I mean, the bottom line is there's nothing on the table. And to me, that's, you know, fairly sickening. And so I take President Obama's comments, you know, at heart. And then I love the fact that Bloomberg is Menino, Mayor Menino, backing these ads with the Sandy Hook families now.
$12 million out of Bloomberg's one of his organizations fund these ads in states where there are recalcitrant legislators.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm dying to talk about this. Mm-hmm. New England Patriots linebacker Ted Johnson said something about Bianca Wilfork, who, of course, is married to another star on the Patriots. Who's the star on the Patriots?
Vince Wilfork.
Mm-hmm. Vince, okay. I'm a big football fan, just like Callie's a big football fan.
Yeah.
But you didn't miss this story, so what happened?
Well, first, let's hear it. This is on a Houston radio station. Ted Johnson, a star linebacker. He played with Wilfork for a little while on the Patriots. Johnson's famous because he's the guy with the concussions, has been very involved in this old brain issue thing that's going on out of Boston University with people like Chris Nowinski and Dr. Cantu, those people. But here is what Ted Johnson said that he apparently regrets big time on a Houston talk station.
Who's got the ugliest spouse? I need his name.
The ugliest spouse!
That's a great
name. Oh, my gosh. He won't hear this. Vince Wilfork.
All right, next item.
Well, that was Ted Johnson, and Vince Wilfork, in fact, did hear that. Vince Wilfork tweeted saying, "You're barking up the wrong tree. I hear and see everything, mother." And then he said the infamous effort.
And he gave a beautiful defense of his wife. I thought it was lovely when he said she's beautiful to the one person that matters. Vince Wilfork.
Well, there's a couple of things here. First of all, Bianca Wilfork, who was the person who was besmirched in this conversation, also tweeted and she said, "My relationship with my husband of 9 years and together for 12 is about being real, being in love, building each other up and having each other's back. Those things can't be measured or determined or valued by looks or money. Those things shine in the darkest times and relish in the best. Love all the support, but trust me, I'm good," which is really, you know, that's a great response. But I thought two things. First of all, whatever happened to loyalty and relationships? I mean, Ted Johnson played with Vince Wilfork, and they, by all accounts, you know, worked very well together, thought much of each other. What is that about? And then second, why always, Marjorie, are women a target for this kind of nonsense?
Always.
Always.
And you know who they're targeted by? Guys who, if they looked in the mirror, have got no business targeting anybody because they're often in much worse condition than the people they're criticizing. The double standard for women drives me nuts from the time I get up in the morning to the time I go to bed at night.
Well, speaking of that, then, you know, what's Ted Johnson was bad enough, but then the DJs or whoever, the host of this show that he was on, and it was a segment called None of Your Business, they went on to just make it even worse. So here's Rich Lord referring to Bianca Wilfork. "The truth of the matter is, this is not somebody you want to wake up next to. Did I go over the line?" he added. "She's got a ways to go before she's even Ricky Lake. I'm trying to back up our boy Johnson here. He spoke the truth." Are you kidding me?
Well, I have to let me preface what I'm about to say by making clear I agree with both of you. I know I'm treading on dangerous territory. Ted Johnson, afterwards, as you know, there are two kinds of apologies. We just discussed this the other week. They're ones that are I'm sorry I got caught, and I'm sorry because of what I said. I heard what Ted Johnson had to say. The guy's got a pretty stellar background. What he said is indefensible. But after the fact, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, I feel horrible about this. You know, I have great admiration for Vince and his wife. Does he get forgiven, or is this so egregious that it's, you know, it's a stain that stays with a guy?
Well, you're talking to somebody who attended a seminar on apology and forgiveness in London, yes. And we had a great amount of conversation about
this. One of my favorite topics. I'm sorry I wasn't
right,
there
so
with
So the
you.
Second part of offering the words of apology is taking the action. That's a good apology. So what action are you taking other than mouthing off, I'm sorry, because, A, I guess you got caught. So I'd like to see what Ted Johnson is doing beyond that. Then, to me, that's a good apology.
So is he walking the walk, not just talking the talk?
Yeah,
after the fact.
I think, right now, I don't know what he's doing.
I think we should have Callie in to do a whole segment on apologies, the right way to make an apology, because I am fascinated by that in politics and in real life, the best way to go about it, and when you do earn the forgiveness, and when people on the other side should you know, give up the ghost kind of deal.
You know, well, through confessions here, we should say that I wanted to be in that seminar because, boy, will I not forgive somebody. It's really hard.
Callie,
I have to work on
Callie,
it. But I know what a good apology is supposed to be.
Now, wait a minute here. You told me a story about somebody, you got some Prada bag or something that fell apart. You chased this person to the ends of the earth to get your refund.
But I want to be on the record for, you know, putting down my shortcomings in this. That's why I wanted to participate in that. But there are two parts to a good apology is the point here.
I think that's a fabulous point. Under the Radar with Callie Crossley is 6:30 every Sunday night. What are you featuring this Sunday, Callie?
Well, we're going to take a deeper look at the report that was just come out looking at Roxbury Community College and the many troubles it's had administratively. This came about after the forced resignation of the last president, Terrence Gomes, and Governor Patrick then moved to replace all of the board members and said, all right, let's just have a deep dive. Goodwin Proctor stood up and offered their services pro bono with Wayne Budd.
Former U.S. attorney, deeply admired
Absolutely.
Man in his community.
Yeah. Damian Wilmot and Abby Hermione of the firm all worked on this extensively. And they really looked at, you know, what some of the key issues were. I mean, there's a couple things to note. First of all, we know the details of the report, and we'll talk about those on Under the Radar, because the college decided to release it. They don't have to. It's not covered under the open documents rules. So they actually could have just put that aside. So they put it out there for everybody to see. Well, I've mentioned that Goodwin Proctor did this pro bono. And it's painful. Some of the revelations here. I mean, it's really painful. At a time when community colleges are poised, particularly in Massachusetts, to really be the place where companies turn for labor, for workforce. That's what Governor Patrick's initiative is all about. That's what his support, and even President Obama is, you know, saying, let's build up community colleges. We can't afford to have a community college in a location that serves so many people to not be in place to accrue the benefits of this time and to help the students who desperately are looking for work and for education.
Also, some of these charges here, which I know you'll go into Sunday night, from both, you know, financial improprieties are one thing. These sexual assault allegations against a person who is in a position of great responsibility and how they were handled is unbelievable.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable.
Well, you know what I have to mention on it's not a lighter note, but it's certainly not as serious as the sexual assault charge. You know, I've been to a million track meets at the the Reggie Lewis track because my kids ran track in high school. And you always wonder places now that are pretty big now when they don't take, you know, credit cards and there's no sort of receipt. You know, what's real?
They didn't take credit cards?
You pay them cash to go in. And I'm always suspicious of people in 2013 who won't take anything but cash.
Yes.
And now you find out there was no documentation for years on the cash income taken at the Reggie Lewis track and field place. So I thought.
And to your point, huge track meets and all kinds of stuff
going on
there.
All over the state.
Yes,
I think they even have ones from the New England states. It's a beautiful actual place. But I was always suspicious.
And I also just want to say that this was the heart work of a former city councilor, now deceased, Bruce Bowling. I mean, he wanted this play. He worked hard for Roxbury Community College to become a reality. And I just felt so bad when I read this and thought about him and the work and others too, not just him alone, but
yeah.
But you know, certainly since we just lost him last year, to think about it in that way.
Well, also the final yeah. thought, I'm so with you. Deval mm-hmm. Patrick mm-hmm. has plowed into these things big time as a job creation thing, same with Obama. And the problem is often the case with a public that has half attention, which is why it's great you're focusing on this, is when there's a taint on one community college, yes. it tends fairly or unfairly to trickle down to the whole system, which is
not
a nightmare.
Fair.
Callie, mm-hmm. we'll be listening okay. Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, 6:30 this Sunday and every Sunday. Callie, thanks. Great to see you.
Keep after the person that sold you the bad bag, Callie. That's all I can say. Chase him. South America, North America, Russia, wherever you're going to go.
That's my kind of style. I love
okay.
that.
Okay. Coming up, Michelle Dillon joins us for an update on Pope Francis, how he's doing just a few days into his popedom, if that's even a word. Stay with us here on 89.7 WGBH.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. In the next couple of segments, I guess you could call our tribute to Easter, or Easter special, the Pope and then Peeps. We'll get to Peeps in a couple of minutes. But in terms of the Pope's first few weeks on the job, we're joined by the woman who actually helped get us through Pope Francis' selection and installation. She's written extensively about Catholicism, and she's the chair of the Sociology Department at UNH. Michelle Dillon, welcome back to Boston Public Radio.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be back.
So, Michelle, give us the good news about Pope Francis and the not-so-good news.
Oh, well, I think it's probably mostly good news, although that may vary depending on who you talk to. But I think, you know, so far so good. I think all his moves and gestures since becoming Pope have been well received, and I think quite full of a lot of important symbolism in terms of reaching out to Catholics globally and showing that Catholicism is about inclusivity, I would say.
Let's start with a small thing for a minute. I think I was talking to you, Michelle, and if not, it was right after you on the show with us. I said, if this guy lived in a one-room apartment in Buenos Aires, took the bus, mm-hmm. why can't he live in a small apartment in Rome, in the Vatican, rather than living in the penthouse that popes have lived in for, I guess, 100 years? Well, it turns out, I don't know yes. if he was listening
he was.
To Boston Public Radio.
Must have been listening
right,
to you, Jim.
It seems as a non-Catholic, Michelle, I think this move to this modest two-room apartment where he's going to be doing communal meals with staff and other priests, I think it's huge. Is it not?
It is huge. I think there's a couple of things to say about it. I think, in fact, one of the things you could say, as well as obviously the symbolism of him having a less ostentatious, if you like, or a less regal obvious lifestyle, but that's obviously a good thing because Catholicism and Christianity have always emphasized concern for the less well-off, and that one doesn't need to live large in order to be a good person. But I also think what's significant is that I think he's partly staying in the residence because he values the community of being with others like him, not being isolated, not becoming an isolated figure that may be more likely to happen in the palace of the Pope himself. On the other hand, of course, you know, the papacy and I think Catholics, particularly American Catholics, while they often disagree with what the Pope say, they value the symbolism mm-hmm. of Rome and of the papacy. So they wouldn't want to see him totally, downsize, if you will. So I think it's also still important to be seen with the trappings of the Vatican, and that, you know, of course, when he will do his Sunday audience and bless people, for example, on Easter Sunday, he will do it from the regular balcony, I presume, and meet and have his audiences, you know, in a more regal setting than in his regular apartment.
But there are a couple of specific things he did, which are, you know, it seems amazing that this is such a big deal, but it shows how far in out of the mainstream the Catholic Church is, that he included women for the first time
yes.
on Holy Thursday when he was washing their feet, and he did it instead of at the St. Peter's Basilica or at the a big church. He did it at a youth prison, never done before.
Yes, I think this, of all the things that have happened, this certainly to me is really the one that stands out the most. Going to a juvenile detention center, you know, going to a very ordinary sort of place rather than doing it in a basilica or a cathedral. And then the fact of washing the feet of the apostles or the stand-ins for the apostles, that's not new because the church has been doing that at the local level for years, as well as bishops. But what was really symbolic and I thought quite amazing was the mix of people of the 12 whose feet he washed, that, as you say, the fact it included women, in particular, as well as obviously non-Catholics, because one of the main reasons that the Vatican has long taught for opposing women's ordination, for example, is that because Christ only chose 12 men as his apostles, that conveyed Jesus's intentions that he did not want women to be apostles or want women to be priests. And so yet we see last night, on Thursday, he choosing among the 12 women. So that, I think, was very significant.
You know, Sean O'Malley did an about-face about this locally a couple of years ago, because remember he got in trouble for having not washing the feet of women at the Cathedral of the Holy Cross, and then he did an about-face and he did wash the feet of women. So I guess cardinals have done it, but not popes.
Well, not popes, but also on such a global stage to do it, I do think it's highly symbolic.
But Michelle, we're talking to Michelle Dillon from University of New Hampshire. If, and I'm not very schooled in the history of Catholicism, so I know you'll disabuse me of this thought if I'm wrong. If the basis for only washing the feet of men is that because Jesus's apostles were all men, and if the same all-male apostle thing is why is what Catholic leaders have rested their only male priest thing on, then if it's okay to wash the feet of women, why isn't it the natural extension that it's okay to have women as priests?
Well, I would just say the first thing is, I think with this washing of the feet in general, that's not really about who's the apostles necessarily, but it is about showing that Christ came to serve, not to be served. I mean, that's the main point, and it happens on Holy Thursday because that celebrates the Eucharist and the Last Supper. So I think that's the main, if you like, theological point of the washing of the feet, is to show that being a priest, being a bishop, being a pope is a vocation of service, and that you're there to serve others. I do think when you start probing further, yes, this is Catholic teaching, that one of the main reasons why women can't be priests is because Jesus doesn't intend it. And part of this reasoning is that even if the pope was a good feminist himself, he can't contravene the intentions and will of Jesus by calling women to be priests. So in this sense, from the symbolism of this, it certainly opens up the idea that, well, you know, if this pope in particular is there including women in this very important symbolic act, that perhaps it shows a greater openness to reassessing or reconsidering church teaching on who can be ordained.
We're talking with Michelle Dillon from UNH. There is one thing that many people have written about, and that's that while the pope has not been accused of covering up any sex abuse in Argentina, he has been certainly called on the carpet for not offering apologies or financial restitution to victims. Even when the priests were sent to jail, he hasn't been really that forthcoming at all on sex abuse cases in Argentina. And by the way, they're sort of behind us in the United States in terms of victims even coming forward.
Well, you know, as we've said before, almost all cardinals who were in Rome for his election were implicated one way or the other in the church's sex abuse scandal. I mean, it's very hard, given their positions in the church and as they ascended the hierarchy of the church in terms of their own careers, almost all of them were touched by this in one way or another. And so, yes, I do think that's going to be shadowing almost every cardinal, and including then who becomes pope.
I told a story, I don't know if it was to you, Michelle, I know I told it to Marjorie, that at the time immediately after Pope Francis, and obviously this is a function of being from the Northeast, immediately after he was named and we heard about him, I typed into Google Pope his original name and sex abuse, and nothing came up. And I felt a little guilty for having done it. That night, I interviewed on television one of the survivors of pre-sex abuse. Later that night, Marjorie and I both got an email from a friend of ours who was a female victim of sex abuse. They both said the first thing they did was type in his name and see if there was sex abuse. And at least there was no, I guess, affirmative bad behavior. The worst there was, according to the Washington Post story, was silence, which I'm not defending, but he was not an actor.
Right. I mean, there's so much culpability across so many sectors of the church on this, but compared to, say, somebody like Cardinal Law or even Cardinal Mahoney, it seems to be a very different sort
Mahoney
of scenario.
Mahoney from L.A., who those don't know. Yeah.
But Michelle, one more question for me. It seems to me that if the Catholic Church is going to restore its moral authority all around the world, I mean, more than women becoming priests, more than, revamping the divorce and remarriage laws or anything, they have got to embrace a full transparency, we really screwed up and we're going to make amends stance on child sex abuse, or they can't move on to anything else.
Oh, yes. And I'm certainly not implying by my comments on the symbolism, even of the washing of the feet, that there's going to be, you know, change anytime soon on women's ordination, goodness, or any of these issues. Yes, I mean, I know the world is looking to Rome now and to this new pope to see how he is going to deal with the whole issue of transparency and decision-making in the church, and taking responsibility for acts, not just of individual priests, but for the church officials themselves and how they have covered it up. And I think that's going to be the real challenge. So these first few days have been, you know, quite positive in terms of a lot of nice symbolism, but there's still a lot of hard decisions that this pope will have to make soon.
Michelle Dillon, before you go away, what we're going to talk about in a minute, I want to ask you for 30 seconds. I've come to be very fond of you over the radio. Tell me you do not eat marshmallow peeps during Easter weekend, please.
I certainly do not eat marshmallow peeps.
I would have expected nothing else. Michelle Dillon from UNH, thanks so much for
thank
your time.
Thank you very much. Happy Easter. Thank you both very much for being with us. Thank you both.
You know, the some of this writing about the Pope says that Republicans have a problem with Pope Francis because he's a big environmentalist and a big lefty, so we'll see how that turns out. Anyway, we are going to talk about peeps. It's that time of year once again. Time to gorge on those delectable Easter candies that people love to hate, including me, but Jim loves them. Peeps, up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
The world tastes good. Who can take a rainbow, wrap it in a sigh, soak it in the sun and make a strawberry lemon pie?
The Candyman?
The Candyman. The Candyman can. The Candyman can, cause he mixes it with love.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. We promised you on Good Friday before Easter we'd talk about the Pope and peeps. And I Marjorie knows I'm a relatively open-minded person. I have a pretty decent... I don't? I'm not?
No, you are, Jim.
I have a pretty good ability to, with a couple of notable exceptions, to see both sides. One place, Marjorie misrepresented my position on this, where I don't see the other side, which is why Americans, this is true, this weekend will eat, I hope you're sitting down, 600 million peeps. Those little marshmallow chicks. They used to be just yellow. They come in a variety of colors. 600 million peeps will be ingested this weekend. I'll do the math for you. That's two peeps for every man, woman, and child. Since I will not be eating one, obviously that means more by others. So we want to know at 877-301-8970, which side are you on? Are you in the pro-peep constituency or the anti-peep constituency? And apparently, since we're both no to peeps, Marjorie, mm-hmm. we're in the minority amongst our fellow Americans.
And I didn't realize, Jim, too, that there were these peep-off contests every year all across the country mm-hmm. where young people, old people, women, men get together and they figure out how many peeps they can stuff down their gullets in so many times. I have a quiz for you, Jim.
Yeah, go ahead.
The last Sacramento peep-off winner ate how many peeps in 30 minutes?
30 minutes, I would say 100.
You're very close.
And what's the answer?
Actually, 102. It was not easy.
You ever eaten one, by the way, in all seriousness?
Yes, I hate them. And I think they're horrible.
The only good thing, a good peep, in my opinion, is a dead peep. And what I've done, like a lot of people, is you put them in the microwave, you put it on high, and it explodes, and then you have your kid clean it up.
That's fun.
It is. But in all seriousness, I know a lot of my friends,
they're big into them.
They wait, they
huge.
Line them up.
They're huge.
They let them get stale throughout the whole year.
Well,
then they pop them in the microwave.
That's supposed to make them taste better if they're stale through the whole year. They will survive, of course, the nuclear holocaust.
Yes,
we all
will.
Know that they're sort of indestructible. And the favorite color, of course, is the yellow peep. You know why, Jim?
No,
because
I don't.
The yellow peep is supposed to look like the little Easter chick. People used to buy Easter chicks. I think the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals got involved and said it was really cruel to get these little chicks for your kids at Easter and then not take care of them. But that's supposed to represent the yellow peep. And how many calories does a peep have, Jim?
I was just about that. I just read, so I cannot tell a lie. 32 calories. There's zero fat. So I guess the plus is if you're going to eat there's no plus. 877-301-8970. We're talking about the pros and cons of the favorite mm-hmm. Easter candy. Peeps, if you just tuned in, I'm going to say it one more time, one time only. 600 million peeps will be eaten by Americans this very weekend. Let's go to Robert. You're in Townsend. We're talking peeps here on Boston Public Radio.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, I love peeps.
Why is that, please?
I'm probably eating all of yours, Jim.
I hope so. Why?
They're just this burst of sweetness. You know, it's like... it's a marshmallow covered in sugar.
Yes.
What's wrong with that?
Well, there's something kind of, I don't know. They just taste kind of gross to me. Maybe it's the little eyes looking up at you. They used to have to paint them on, you know, by hand.
I do know that.
They don't anymore.
Well, I'm sure they're all chemical, but...
All chemicals. You know. All chemicals.
Robert, just to put this in context, because I don't know, is a peep a specialty for you, or are you just an all candy all the time guy, and this happens to be the candy of the weekend?
Do I have to be honest?
Well, I knew what the answer was. Robert, thank you. Thank you kindly for your call. So that's one vote for Peeps. Can we hear Justin Bieber was on Conan O'Brien last year?
Yes.
He said he was sick of Sour Patch Kids, and he decided to choose a new favorite candy. Then we'll get back to your calls.
Everybody brought me Sour Patch Kids.
Right.
And then I got so sick of them.
And they started throwing them at you in concert.
Yeah.
And you're getting pelted. You just happened to mention you like Sour Patch Kids. Next thing you know, they're being launched at you.
Exactly. So I have a new favorite candy. And
you have a new favorite candy. Are you going to tell people what that is?
Well, I don't really like want to because of...
Come on, we're on pretty late. Not a big deal. You can tell us what your new favorite kind of candy is.
You promise you won't tell
me? I won't tell anybody.
You guys tell anyone?
We won't tell anybody. None of us, no.
You know those marshmallow Peeps?
Peeps are fantastic. You're going to have a great...
They drop like 2,000 Peeps on Justin Bieber's head.
That was pretty good.
It's really great. But they do have the Peep-Offs. They have the Peep-Offs every single year. We have a little sound from one of the Peep-Offs, too. The Dartmouth College cycling team is battling the UVM cycling team at their annual Peeps contest. This has not happened yet this year because it happens right this weekend. But here's last year's.
You have to completely finish eating your handful of Peeps and swallow their swallow
open
before
now.
The next person can start eating them.
Okay. I'll judge okay.
Sound good?
Hey! Peep-Off!
How do these people get into Dartmouth and UVM? That's what I want to know. 877-301-8970. This is one of the few things Marjorie and I walk in lockstep on. Let's go to Bob. You're in Burlington. We're discussing the fascination with Peeps that most Americans have this very weekend. Hey, Bob.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent. How are you?
I'm doing great. So here's the thing about Peeps. They're terrible to eat, but they're great for science.
How so?
So you can do all kinds of really cool things with Peeps. Like you talked about sticking them in the microwave until they explode.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's really fun.
Yeah, well, you know, talk to your kids about why that happens. Talk to them about, you know, the expansion that happens. Vinegar and baking soda and Peeps. Oh, man, that is a good afternoon.
What
now, what happened? Yeah, exactly.
They will dissolve. They will dissolve like at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
You know how to live, Bob. I can tell.
Hey, Bob, why do the Peeps explode at the microwave? I'm an idiot at this kind of stuff. Tell me.
So basically what's going on is simple. So what a microwave does is it shoots some radiation, and it's hoping to find some asymmetric molecules to make jiggle. And some of the most asymmetric molecules out there are water, fat, and sugar. Boom.
Okay.
I
got it.
They start jiggling. They start heating up, and they start expanding.
It is funny to watch them. I was
Bob,
cruising.
Bob, thanks for the
YouTube
call, Mr.
Today
Wizard. We appreciate it.
For some, you know, to get to the bottom of all the Peep frenzy this time of year. And you do see when they first go into the microwave, you see them sort of sit up at attention. The Peeps get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then boom.
When was the last time you had one?
When you made me, when you
couple
brought
years
them in the
ago.
Studio and we had to eat them in the studio, yeah. And it was absolutely disgusting.
Maybe, you know, it is true. It, some people who like marshmallows actually don't like marshmallows in the form of a Peep. So maybe it is because it has eyes, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you feel like you're eating one of the little chickadees that you used to get in a little box.
I want you to tell
Easter
you right
Sunday.
Here, I would eat a little chickadee before I'd eat a Peep. Let's go to Narja. You're in Ashland. You're on with Jim and Marjorie. Welcome, Narja.
Finally found you.
Here we are. Oh. We've been waiting for you. How are you, Narja?
Peeps brought you in.
How about you?
Good.
Great. We're great. What's up?
I'm glad you're back.
Thank you.
Peeps. I don't like them.
Now, why is that, Narja?
Like
why?
Too sweet. Very, very sweet.
They are very sweet. They're very, very sweet. The kids.
I didn't even like them as a kid.
I didn't like them as a kid. Actually, that's a good point. I didn't like them as a kid when you were supposed to like them either. And, Narja, we're glad you found us and keep finding us every day from noon to 2.
I'm so glad, too. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you.
Where are we going now? Let's go to Bill, who's on the road somewhere.
Wait, before we go to Bill, I want you to know that Abby, one of our coworkers, just brought in 3 snowman-shaped Peeps.
Yeah, well, you can eat them, Jim. I'm going to take a pass. Bill on the road, what do you think about Peeps?
Quite attractive, actually.
Well, thank you, Marjorie. First of all, wonderful to hear you back.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
My favorite story about Peeps is, first of all, I don't care for them very much, but they always show up inevitably at any event that I go to around Easter time.
Mm-hmm.
And what always has struck me is I think first they're hermetically sealed, because after opening them for maybe within 10 or 15 minutes, they already start to crust over and become hot as a rock.
No, they do, of course.
They do, very quickly.
Oh, yes. And they have, they used to have, I don't know if they still have, this little tiny tail on the back.
Mm-hmm, they do.
I find that they make excellent doorstops.
Okay.
Bill, it's a bad connection. Thanks for the call. But the doorstop thing is, it's being creative with
Stephen
the peep. Yes.
Has an email. He says he lives by a simple rule. If the color cannot be found in nature, I do not put that food in my mouth. And that is a good point, is it not? I mean, they have
But they come
fluorescent.
In a lot of... No, but they're doing
they're
other...
fluorescent colors. They're lavender colors. They're these weird fluorescent blue. They're not normal. They're normal colors.
During Easter, one more peep factoid before we take a final call. Peeps outsell jelly beans, and the primary manufacturer of Peeps is this company called Just Born. Also makes hot it's a candy man. Hot tamales, Mike and Ike. I happen to like Mike and Ike, and Just Born jelly beans. Let's take one more peep caller if we can. Let's go to Andrea. You are in Plymouth, and you're on Boston Public Radio. Hello, Andrea.
Good afternoon, actually.
Hi, it is actually afternoon. Hi, welcome.
Thank you. I love Peeps.
Why is that, please?
I love them and I freeze them.
And then what do you do with them?
Well, I think you can savor them in your mouth longer when they're frozen.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, they all taste the same, even though they're different colors. But I love them all.
Okay, before you go, Andrea, if 600 million are eaten by your fellow Americans over Easter weekend, what share of the 600 million do you ingest?
Yeah, I'm afraid I wouldn't do more than probably four.
Andrea, we'll write you down for four. Thanks so much for the call.
Jim Brady, I want to point out just two more quick Peeps
do,
facts
yeah.
here. Well, since 2006, the Washington Post has hosted an annual Peeps Diorama Contest.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, over 1,100 people entered their dioramas made completely of Peeps. The winner last year was a diorama based on the Pixar film Up. And listen to this.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want to have to go to a peep off show, for a quicker, easier peep show, what you do is engage in peep jousting. You put two peeps facing each other in the microwave for 1 minute, stick a toothpick in the chest of each, and they will joust inside the microwave.
You know how much we're missing out on, by the way, because of our bias against peeps? It's frightening. So that's it for peeps, at least for this Easter. We'll get back to it next Easter.
I can't wait till next Easter, Jim.
Nor
so
can
we can
I.
Talk about this again. Okay, up next, I'm going to be joined by Emily Rooney. Here she's our open mic guest on Friday in Studio 3. Stay tuned to Boston Public Radio, WGBH 89.7.
This would be Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Every Friday on Open Mic, we're joined by our Boston Public Radio colleague. She's the host of WGBH's Greater Boston, which becomes magically Beat the Press on Fridays, like tonight, for example. Hello, Emily Rooney.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. How are you?
Fine. Before you proceed with whatever is on your agenda today, Emily Rooney, the other day on our Ask The feature, the Secretary of Transportation, former head of the T, Rich Davey, joined us, and he actually brought in something for you.
Yeah,
let's hear
where
Rich.
Is it?
Well, you'll get it in a second. If you missed it on Wednesday, well, you were greedy. Here is Rich Davey. Listen to what he had to say.
I think Emily Rooney was on your show recently and mentioned
every Friday,
to my shock that she has never been on the MBTA.
She's never been on the team.
Which is outrageous. So what I brought for you, obviously folks can't see it, but I brought a system map for her, a Charlie Card discount book, a Charlie Card with no money on it, but I slipped in $2
of your own money?
And I'm happy to give her a tour of the system if she wishes.
Personally, you would.
Yeah, I know she's a neighbor, so I'll find her. We'll get on the green line.
2 o'clock,
we'll
be in her
possession. We'll find the Boylston Noise. We'll get the signs up. We'll do it together.
Well, she didn't get them at 2 o'clock as promised. Here's the map. Here's the Charlie Card loaded with $2. What are you?
I've
seen
it.
$2 of his own money, and also he has one of those things he can put around your neck,
a lanyard,
like a lanyard,
I
so you
I
can have
lanyards.
Your Charlie Card on your
All right,
lanyard.
Well, Jim,
there you go.
This is a perfect segue because I've got two MBTA stories that you.
you and Marge are going to love, but you in particular.
Okay, I'm
because
ready.
They totally put me to shame.
Okay, good.
All right, so I'm coming out of my bank last Saturday morning. It's absolutely frigid, arctic. You know, it's like I'm Boylston Street. People are walking really quickly. I see this guy coming toward me with one of those chartreuse vests, and he's got a white cane. He's going, and I hear him yelling out, but people are blowing by him, and, you know, you don't know whether it's somebody who's panhandling or they're really blind. So I get close to him, and I hear him saying, "Is it Boylston Street? Is this Boylston Street?" And I said, "Yes, sir, it's Boylston Street." He reaches out. He takes my arm. He says, "You've got to get me to the Dunkin' Donuts." And I'm thinking, "Where is the Dunkin' Donuts?" Anyway, it was up the street a little ways. He says, "I've got to get to the Dunkin' Donuts and get a sandwich because I'm on my way to the Apple store to get a lesson on mountain lion." And he's clearly blind. I said, "Mountain lion?" Now he's got me stumped twice. I don't even know what mountain lion is. And so I say, "Well, you know, what's your name?" And he says, he asks my name. I tell him, and I said, "What's your name, Dennis?" And I said, "Well, Dennis, where do you live?" He said, "I live in North Quincy." I said, "No, wait a second." I said, "How did you get here?" He says, "I took the T."
Well, of course.
I'm thinking, I wouldn't even have known, you know, where the T is in North. He gets on the T. He's blind.
And you're sighted, for those who
yes,
don't know.
Exactly.
We should make
oh
that
gosh.
Clear.
So
are you humiliated?
I was dumbstruck. And then I felt so, you know, I walked Dennis to the Dunkin' Donuts and then took him up to the Apple store.
Oh,
I said, "Dennis, are you
going
to be okay without me?" But I thought, and then I'm just, and all I could think about was you. Because I thought, here this guy, completely blind, you know, only wanted to know whether he was on Boylston Street, managed his way on the T. It's pretty incredible.
Dennis, if you're listening, give us a buzz. 877-301-8970.
All right, gets
so
worse.
So that was humiliation number one.
Oh,
gets
worse.
Worse.
Yeah, gets worse.
Okay.
My brother's in town. He's got his daughter here. He's taking her around to all the colleges and universities, you know, Tufts and BU and BC and blah, blah. So he comes into town. He parks, you know, in my garage. I gave him my spot. And, you know, he says, "Well, we're going to take the tea the next day." I blanched because he wants me to show him which tea to get
God.
On to go
oh
to.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't do it.
Oh, my God. It is unbelievable because you don't let that. You're only a couple of blocks
away. Well, I talked
to him.
We walked over to Copley Square. You're right. It's a block and a half.
Block
we have
and
to
a
insist.
Half.
And I'm looking at the signs, and it says, let's see, BC, BU, blah, blah.
Really
oh, my God.
He says, "We'll figure it out. Don't worry."
No, but in all seriousness, we're at the spot now before we move on. I have agreed to carry whatever the crap you carry around in the morning.
No, I want to show people how much I care. I'm not having anybody carry my
Rich
stuff.
Rich Davey is willing to usher you around, I guess, on his free time. He gave $2
look,
of his own money
there really is $2
on the
here.
Charlie card. $2, yeah. So you get a free ride. So you're at least
did you
more.
See the picture of Charlie on there?
Yeah, I know who Charlie
isn't that
is.
Cute?
Yeah,
I think
the
you're,
MBTA.
I think
the
you're softening,
Charlie
don't
on the
you think?
MTA.
Yeah, there he is.
Yeah.
This
it's
is
adorable.
Very sad. Emily
so
Rooney,
sad, isn't
can we talk about
story.
Something else, if we can, for a second? Another sad story. This week, when the when Proposition 8 was argued before the Supreme Court, bless you, Marjorie, and she sneezed, and DOMA the next day, and then the new judge takes over the Bulger case in federal court, and she says the trial's going to go ahead in June or July, June, I guess. I had the same thought about both things. We never got to see the nine justices. We never got to see the oral argument. And we're not going to get to see Whitey Bulger in the courtroom, even though it's our money that's going to allow the federal government to prosecute him for being a serial killer. Why do we
this
not
is,
have TVs in courtrooms?
This in federal courtrooms.
In federal courtrooms. I'm sorry,
courtrooms
in federal courtrooms, right.
We have TVs in most courtrooms at the discretion of the judge, and I guess I'm pretty much okay with that, except federal courts. You know, you may remember quite a while ago now, like 7 or 10 years ago, they did an experiment here in Boston, and lo and behold, they let us take cameras into a civil federal courtroom, and it was the Xerox trial. And it went on for like 3.5, 6 months, and it was like so boring. I mean, nobody even wanted to bring a camera into the Xerox trial, but they did try it out. But I mean, nothing happened as a result of that. This is a throwback. It's arcane. There's an arrogance to it. That
what's
drives
the, is there
me
argument
out of my,
still that people are going to perform for the camera?
There is no
the,
argument.
No, but
anymore.
Is that what they contend? What do the federal judges argue? Whatever the body is
well,
that
well,
makes the
decision.
Who has
ever approached them? This has to be a larger media, you know. Push.
It's the government. Because, it's the government doing whatever the hell it wants, and not.
That's
and,
exactly right.
And not
see,
allowing people
I'll,
who
I'll
have a vested interest in seeing
everything should be open to
everything.
Cameras, including
absolutely.
Executions, and it has nothing to do with where I feel about executions. It's like our government at work. Why can't we see it? What's wrong with it?
Exactly.
If you're going to do an execution,
Let me see it.
You know, a minute ago when I asked you where does this come from, what's their argument? In my recollection, you probably know this, a couple of years ago there was a huge case, well, there are always huge cases, for the Supreme Court. I don't know if it was Bush v. Gore in 2000. I don't remember what it was. But there was a broad media request that they make an exception in this case. They, the Supreme Court of the United States, make an exception. And it was denied. But the weird thing to me is there's never disagreement amongst federal judges. I assume there's one or two.
But why
you never hear
they,
one outlier say, well, I wish this policy was
William
different.
Decide.
William Young here in Boston has been an outstanding.
See, a district court, a federal district court judge.
District, yes, yeah. He used to be. Maybe you're tired now. But he was actually a big proponent of cameras in the courtroom. I don't know where he stands now. Why do they get to decide? I mean, it's the federal government.
I know, but I mean, this is what scares people about the federal government, you know, when they take it from no cameras in the courtroom to Obamacare is going to kill my grandmother. I mean, the idea that the government is making these rules and that people who legitimately protest them seem to have no venue or no standing.
Well,
the bigger
issue is
drives me crazy.
Why don't the big networks are really the money backing? And by the way, I have to throw PBS into that because PBS of all stations of all networks would be
the most likely to be doing it, right?
So we should all get behind this and make a push to the federal government. It's got to be. And by the way, the New York Times and those, they don't care. You know, although now that you've got streaming video and all that, they might care more.
But you know what really is upsetting about it? Al Johnson has been a lawyer in Boston for a million years, had this great line when he says, nobody cares about the courts until they're in them. And then once they get in the courts, they're stunned by what they see that goes on there. Because unless you're a reporter or you happen to be unfortunate enough to be a defendant or someone in your family, you don't see the way the courts operate. And I think it's really important. That's why court TV was for a long time so popular, because you could see the government functioning, and I don't think.
But I mean, there is, to go back to your question, Jim. You know, like even none of us really understand why there's so much attention to that Jodi Arias case. But the fact that there has been. Oh yeah, the sex and the blonde and the transformation.
CNN
all, that. But,
all the time, by the way, every
but
night.
But I sincerely believe that trial, that case, has been prolonged because of the media attention. And the cameras in the courtroom, it's like, it's a cut and dry case. She killed the guy. I mean, it's like, it's
so you're
it's
arguing
not big,
against yourself.
I
then.
Am. I know. But I think that's one of the reasons why.
But there are always exceptions. I mean, the O.J. Simpson case, I think, where the Judge Ito got carried away. Remember, there were the Dancing Itos on the Jay Leno show. And there was a lot of performing for the cameras there. But
weren't you glad that trial was televised, though?
Yes.
It was just riveting.
Yes. The taxpayers are paying for this. Yeah. We're paying for the federal
courts. It's also anti-democratic.
We're paying the salary of the judges. Why do we get rolled over? We get rolled
We're
over
all on the same page.
You know, I didn't know about the Xerox. Was it Xerox?
Xerox.
Is it possible that they chose that case because they knew it would be as deadly as dull?
It was a trial period, and that was just the trial that happened to come up during that trial period, and it went on forever. It was right here in Boston.
You know, the other absurdity, and then we'll believe it. I think we should do a show on this next week or the following week or the following week about putting some pressure on the
because we
media
want to be
giants.
In that Whitey trial,
no,
don't we?
No, seriously.
We do want to be in that Whitey trial, and you're not going to be able to fit in the courtroom, although it is funny how many times, I don't know if people even know this, most of the time you can fit in the courtroom. I mean, the Sal DeMasi trial, which is a pretty big trial, former Speaker of the House, was pretty empty most of the time. You could stroll right in there any day wanted
to. That was federal also. I mean,
it was federal.
And the other thing is that Whitey could easily betray it on a state charge, too. I mean, the feds have got him, you know, crossing state lines and all that stuff. But, you know, he could be tried again in another courtroom.
Well, that was the point I was going to make. If it's such a sacred notion that we keep cameras out of the courtroom, what would a Supreme Court justice say? It's okay if Whitey Bulger was tried on criminal charges on state charges to see what happens, but it's not okay if he's tried, which he is being tried on federal, which points to the absurdity of the thing even more. So,
and trials are fascinating too.
They are.
You know, as a reporter, there's nothing more fun than a good.
I know. I covered that Herald libel trial with Judge Ernest Murphy. That was one of the most entertaining ones I've ever been at.
I hate
to tell you.
Yeah,
it was though, because of him.
Well,
he was entertaining.
I would also
like
to say, as a non-Herald employee, in my humble opinion, one of the worst decisions in
the history of humankind.
I agree.
I came 180 degrees on that one. I'm here to confess.
Letters from that judge. I know
I saw them.
Pat Purcell, the publisher of the Herald, were tantamount to extortion.
I know.
It was just stark. In any case, let's move on to one more media thing. Tom Menino yesterday at 4:00. Again, we haven't spoken since. I thought his speech was spectacular. I thought the ad-libbing afterwards was really funny and heartfelt, that sort of thing. But You notice in the last, you had this exclusive with Tom and Eno about a week or so ago. And since this has happened, he's appeared on some shows. He's done some interviews. He hasn't appeared on other shows. Tom and Eno does play favorites.
I have a little theory. Oh, absolutely.
What is your theory?
He's actually giving one to John Keller this afternoon. He really favors the veteran reporters who know what they're talking about. I mean, I've had so many conversations with him, you know, where he'll name names too, people who don't know what they're talking. You know who this one is from? You can't believe what they asked me. So he's.
Is that why we can't get him on the radio today?
I mean, you know, I'm not sure they might also consider GBH as all. You know, they get.
We have so many vying interests
here at GBH. You know, between my show and your show, and and you've got your show at NECN. So it's like a lot of different. But I'm sure he'll do it at some point. But there's no question that he plays favorites. You know, he's very good friends, very close with Susan Wojcicki. He gave her that first interview while he was still. In rehab last fall. She was the only one who got that. And then right after he came out, he did a couple other veterans. He actually gave one to John Keller then. He gave one to Maria Stefanos. But he's not done everybody. He hasn't done a blanket thing.
But is that different from any other? When you mention this, is it there other major pals? I mean, obviously, if you're the governor of the Commonwealth, you can't not talk to people when there's a. But who doesn't play favorites amongst the big boys and
not
girls?
Not with the level of sophistication that he doesn't.
So you're saying it's because he gets annoyed by the lack of preparation and knowledge by the young
stupidity, as he put it.
Stupidity.
I mean,
well, that's good.
Scott Brown played favorites on ideological lines. I mean, he did. That was his prerogative.
I would have to disagree with you. I think
you may have been the exception.
He was a pretty regular caller in the early days.
Excuse me.
What, you disagree with that?
No, there was a total bromance going on between Jim Brown
and
Scott Brown.
What do you mean there had to be?
I would watch when Jim would get these texts, and all of a sudden his face would light up.
It's Scott Brown.
Just texted.
I believe it. I can see it's true.
Scott would come in the studio and he'd have a form-fitting T-shirt on and a nice
pair. We call him Senator Brown,
Marjorie. Yes, and Jim would just...
You were the exception. He's changing the subject.
No, I am changing. I want to get back to Menino. Very skillfully,
Emily.
I should say.
In love.
In case you one last thing about Menino, I'm going to try this anyway. One half of me says you got to be accessible to everybody. The other half of me says if that's really his motivation, he's gone where the brains are in the media. Sort of like that. Don't you?
Absolutely.
Because there's so many insipid questions from so many unbelievably uninformed reporters that you sort of like the fact that the guy has some judgment. I'm going to go ahead.
I know. I have some fun. Actually, it's not insipid, but Hank Fivley Ryan, I have her peppering him with something. This is 4 years ago. I'm using that tonight on Beat the Press at 7. And you can see him go, his shoulders just saying, you idiot. And then
she's a good reporter.
Oh, she's great. She says to him, well, thank you very much for putting up with me, he says, give me a break, or something like that. You know, he just spits it back in.
Speaking of Beat the Press, which is Friday nights at 7 o'clock, Marjorie is an occasional guest, though not this Friday. What are you doing tonight?
We're doing a lot of stuff. We're doing a whole thing about how David Bernstein from the formerly of the Boston Phoenix, because it doesn't exist anymore, broke the story, and whether there was indeed an embargo. Which we're still trying to nail that down. There was something that seemed like it was some kind of embargo imposed on both the Boston Herald and the Boston Globe, although Brian McGrory didn't use that term.
Brian was on those yesterday. Yeah. He did say, in not so many words, that they decided for a variety, I'm sure you'll play it.
We did decide
out of courtesy, and the words weren't his words, to hold this for a little bit of time.
Well, wasn't it that once Bernstein broke the story, then everybody said, what are we going to do?
But I mean, I think both the Herald and the Globe kind of hamstrung themselves. They sort of like, they would have had it first had they not agreed to any kind of... parameters on what they were going to report. And by the way, I can't even imagine why anybody would agree to it, because this thing was falling out. I got a call at 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. On Wednesday afternoon. So it seemed like, or whenever that was, Wednesday. It seemed like it was all going to come apart before that.
Well, there were a lot. So many people said that they had met with him and they were convinced he was not going to run.
No one
was saying, at least as far as I knew.
Because he was going to wait until his staff and all that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's interesting. An unemployed reporter kind of is the one who breaks it.
Well, it's also one of the ironies of that. Well,
for more, because for long, because he's a great reporter.
Well, not only unemployed, the Boston Phoenix, after years and years and years, goes out of business the week before the biggest story in 20 years in Boston.
So I have to ask, Emily, we have the whole lineup in the Herald today of every person who could possibly be running for mayor. Now, do you have a favorite in this group here?
Two of them are going to be in the studio for the All Money No News Quiz.
Peter Jackson, he's terrific. He was on your show last night. I thought he was great.
Felix Arroyo.
I got to give the nod to the edge. I'll put the nod. The edge to Dan Conlon.
Because he's got $850,000 in the bank.
Also, he's been Mayor Menino's buddy, and he said he would wait. He was deferring to the mayor on his decision whether to run. I think, you know, the mayor said yesterday he wouldn't help anybody, or however he put it. But, you know, I think he would.
If he had $100,000 in the bank, would you be saying the same thing?
Yes.
You would. You would.
And what do you think? Now, Jim said before that he thought it was possible because Sonia Chang Diaz is the only female that would divide the... I don't see that either.
No.
No, I don't either. Okay, takes care of that theory, Jim.
So, before you go, Emily, when do you think you'll be using those gifts from the Secretary
of
Transportation?
Well, you and I are going to talk later, and we're going to figure
out...
You'll do it? Yeah, of course.
Fine.
Yeah, sure.
It's a deal. You heard it here on Boston Public Radio.
By the way, I had you pegged for a peep eater.
Peep eater?
I did.
No, I will. There's virtually no
everything.
Food
exactly.
that I will
he has
not eat.
No discrimination
I do not
whatsoever.
Eat cold goat cheese and peeps. Those are the only
cold
two.
Goat cheese. I love that.
Well,
do you like
it
baked?
I love it baked.
Yeah.
I love
Isn't
it.
That funny?
Emily Rooney, Greater Boston, and Beat the Press. Great show on Friday night, 7 o'clock. Emily, great to see you. We'll see you in a couple of days.
Emily Rooney, thank you so much as always. Up next, we're going to touch with a couple of sports reporters about March Madness and a couple of controversies in the sporting world. You're listening to Boston Public
Radio.
She
just put her Charlie card around her neck.
Very
I want to make that clear.
Emily, that's lovely.
Andrea's head tingles.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We're down to 12, and by bedtime, it'll be 8. 8 schools left in college basketball's March Madness. Here to discuss a variety of things. Bracket depression, the brief Harvard boomlet, Florida Gulf Coast's magical ride, and a white sportscaster's pronouncement are Chris Collins from NECN Sports, and Shira Springer's on the phone, by the way. She's the enterprise sports reporter of the Boston Globe. Hey, Shira and Chris.
Hello.
Hi.
Jimmy, Marjorie, good to see you again as always. I love coming in.
You do?
Seeing, Marjorie's so hot.
Okay, on that note, we'll see if he got in trouble. Doug Gottlieb, who I must say I never heard of. Thank you, Shira. Doug Gottlieb is a white sportscaster on CBS. I think it's CBS, is it not? And right before they broadcast the Marquette-Miami game last night, he had this to say. Listen up.
Cream rising to the crop. I don't know why you guys asked me. I'm just here to bring diversity to this set here. Give the kind of white man's perspective on things. Sure. Point guard position. No.
Marquette, Miami.
How about you guys?
No, I'm just checking, man. I'm just checking. You jumped right into it. You're swimming hard.
Okay.
Swimming hard. Upstream, I might add.
We'll get you back before the end of the night.
Little nervous laughter after that. On the set, Sir Charles Barkley, formerly of my hometown team, the 76ers, talks about the firestorm in seconds, and he tries to set the record straight. Here's Barkley.
I want to say something about Doug Gottlieb. He made a joke earlier tonight, and people are going crazy, all those idiots on Twitter, which I would never, ever do. Listen, me, Kenny, and Greg Athey and Greg Gumman did not take that personally. So all you people at home who got no life, who are talking bad about Doug Gottlieb, get a life. It's over with. It is no big deal.
Chris Collins, you are a black sportscaster. Did you take it personally?
Well, I did. I mean, the point guard's perspective, I wanted to hear something from the shooting forward perspective. That would have been much more, you know, towards what I was looking for out of the telecast. And I do come here, obviously, as someone who's going to bring a little diversity.
Diversity, that's correct.
I'm from the North Shore, and I'm bringing the North Shore perspective,
there
which, of course, you do not have.
I know you. There's not a piece of this that bothered you, is it? Or am I inappropriately speaking for you?
You know what? The only thing, it didn't bother me. I thought it was kind of comical because, right, it was so awkward. And the problem is this. Jimmy, you and I go back and forth all the time. And we've known each other for a long time. And we talk about, you know, your little beanie that you wear for the high holiday. And you talk about Kwanzaa and me celebrating, you know, the holiday that was made up, you know, about 15 years ago. But with that said, we joke about that because we know each other and we're comfortable. Gottlieb comes in and jumps right into the fray. He doesn't know these guys. You can't just say something that makes people a little uncomfortable without the comfort of knowing Greg Anthony, who looked at him really funny.
That
really
look is
funny.
Incredible.
The picture,
yeah.
The picture of his face, he looks like he just said like a really bad
word. He looked like he is a guy who doesn't know the three black guys sitting on the set. And he's like, well, maybe that's out of bounds. I'm not quite sure.
Hey, Cher Springer, what was your take on this? And we should have said Gottlieb came back a little bit later and apologized, said I shouldn't have said it. What was your take on the original pronouncement?
I think, you know, not only do you have to know the people you're with, you have to know the context. There's a time, no, I'm not saying there's ever really a time and a place for that, but it's certainly not on live television during a pregame show. I think he just misjudged his audience both in the studio and on national television entirely. And even sort of what's a little bit sadder about it is, you know, when I look at Doug Gottlieb, I'm coming to him because he's an ex-player. He used to play for Oklahoma State. He was a fairly accomplished player. That's what he brings to the table. You know, he has a very good college player's perspective, and he's been doing this for a long time, and he has a high level of expertise that's really, really respected. And, you know, I don't know if he was trying to be humble, trying to bring levity to the set, but whatever he was trying to do, obviously fell completely flat, and he just completely misjudged everyone and everything.
But Cher Springer, if I can hear, well, Barkley came to his defense big time. This ESPN football analyst and obviously former NFL player, Mark May, said that Gottlieb should be canned. What is going to happen and what should happen to him? Nothing.
He shouldn't be canned. It was, this was, you know, a foot in the mouth moment.
You got to understand that, you know, when you're up there in that situation, that is like, and I don't want to call it the boys club, but I want to call it the fun club, because you got Charles Barkley, who, let's be honest, isn't up there for his college basketball IQ. He's up there because he's an entertainer.
He's a great entertainer.
He knows barely anything about college basketball. I mean, that is what it is. So he's up there to have fun, to throw some jokes, to have some laughs. And the other guys who he works with regularly on the NBA telecasts, that's their role. They feed off of Charles.
Right.
They throw jabs at each other. They make fun at each other. Now, all of a sudden, some outsider comes in and he doesn't even look like them.
Yeah.
Never mind, does he have the NBA pedigree that they all have? And he comes in, he throws a joke, and, you know, it wasn't funny. He missed.
Yeah, he missed. But he missed.
But that's all it was. He missed. It's not a fireable offense. And I think Charles' other point is, you know, all you people on Twitter, I think if we were not in this mega social media generation.
True, right?
It wouldn't have exploded the way it exploded. It would have happened. Listen, the soundbite you played was, 3 to 5 seconds long? It would have been over. A lot of people don't watch the pregame show. They tune in for the actual action. It would have been done, gone, over. Instead, you know, it has a life of its own because of social media. So that's another dimension to it. But you're absolutely right, Chris. You know, Charles is famous for not only making jokes, but sometimes saying very inappropriate things.
Talk about it for 2 seconds had Charles Barkley uttered something similar. I mean,
exactly.
You'd be like, that's Charles being Charles.
Yeah.
That's why
yep.
he's there. And Charles Barkley has, you know, had a strong, obviously a long career. But earlier, when people really didn't know Charles, back when he was with Philadelphia, he used to do and say things all the time that used to get him into serious trouble. Now, because he is who he is, oh, that's just Charles. I mean, he can say pretty much whatever he wants, but just because he has that carte blanche to say whatever he wants doesn't mean Gottlieb can come in and, you know, and shout out anything.
Hey, since we're in the middle of March Madness, Cher, I want to start with you. I want to talk about only two teams. You, as part of your responsibilities, followed the little Harvard boomlet. First time they ever made it to the NCAA. Well, first time, did they ever make it to the NCAA?
Now, mind you, she's a Harvard girl, so be careful what you say.
Well, I'm sorry, it's their second time, but first time they ever won a game. Is that correct?
Correct. First time they ever won a game, third tournament appearance, and but second, you know, consecutive appearance.
And what was that like? I mean, how huge? It was big, right?
It was big. Honestly, I think
apparently not.
I haven't stopped celebrating.
Go ahead, Cher. I'm sorry.
In some ways, it was bigger for the alumni. There was a lot of emails going back and forth among alumni, self-congratulatory emails, shockingly. There was a lot of, you know, postings on Facebook and other social media. But it was funny because it was spring break, and I don't live too far from the campus and you walk around the campus and it was like, huh? Some people weren't even sure what game they had played in the previous night.
That was funny.
I walked into a restaurant that was sort of had a TV on, and you would think, you know, maybe they're getting swept up a little bit in the March Madness frenzy, and the one TV in this restaurant was tuned to the X Games, the Winter X Games. I mean, it was not a groundswell of March Madness frenzy on campus, and typical of Harvard, I think, a lot of kids are focused, very focused on their own thing, and they excel in their own areas and are very narrowly focused.
You mentioned the alumni, and I was getting, because that game was on very late. I think it ended probably close to midnight. I was getting texts and tweets all night from Harvard alum.
Really?
All night. Yes. Couldn't believe what was happening. Can't believe this is the greatest thing that happened to Harvard. Well, and most of my little community, in my little Harvard community is basically all ex, you know, athletes.
Right.
I mean, it is who they are.
But here's the thing about the Ivy League schools that you hear all the time, that they don't technically offer athletic scholarships. So you might get a break. If you're like a B student and you're a great athlete, you'll get a break, but you can't be a C student or a C-minus student
and
still get in.
Yes and no. I mean, they use an equation, a formula. So make a long story short, if you have a couple of eggheads, maybe you got a 6'5 Jewish guy like Jim Brody with a half an afro, and he's getting, 4.0s, you put him on the team, and then maybe you can slide some people in who don't have the 4.0 and the 2400 on the SAT.
Oh, okay.
That's how it's done. And Harvard received a little criticism because they say they have slid the scale back in the day before Amaker, their current coach, they said that the kids that they're letting in now would have never been they couldn't even smell Harvard as far as recruiting them. And that's the criticism they've undergone, that
they made it into the March Madness.
They're in an unprecedented rare air for Harvard basketball. This is the best they've ever been.
And I would say alumni are somewhat divided about that. I mean, in part, they want the success. They want to enjoy sort of that mainstream athletic success. On the other hand, they don't want to become or be perceived as, and I don't think they ever will be, a basketball factory or a place that lowers its standards to raise its basketball profile. I think Harvard's status is pretty secure without having a winning basketball
team. And when you're talking about basketball at the Division I level, and you're talking about letting athletes in, it is what it is. You're talking about primarily race, because that's who's basically feeling – four out of the five starting players on that court, and the coach now is black. So there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of internal thinking and rethinking on the campus of Harvard about where this basketball team is headed and what direction they should continue to go in.
And by the way, speaking of that, I believe this weekend is the annual weekend when Derek Jackson of the Globe's brackets based upon graduation rates of black basketball players comes out. We only have a couple of minutes left. Let's talk about a team that's still in the thing. Now, of course, as you know, Chris, Florida Gulf Coast University, I have in the Final Four on my bracket.
Yeah,
of course.
I saw that.
Okay.
And tell them why.
Why is that?
Oh, because the coach's wife, who is just an ex-model.
Yes.
You clearly have voted.
Exactly, that's what it was. Okay.
Not with your basketball IQ.
First 15th-seeded team to make it into the Sweet 16. But you know what the weird part is? I'm reading Sports Illustrated after they won their first game the other day. Sports Illustrated lists them as the most likely, and I'm paraphrasing, most likely second-tier team to surprise people. So it shouldn't have been such a surprise, should it?
Yes and no.
Yeah, a lot of people said that they were seeded too low, originally.
Because they had a quality win against a tough Miami team that was seeded two in the tournament. And that, I mean, for kids, to look at, I'm in this little rinky-dink school that's basically on the beach. If we can beat a team like Miami, a high-powered Division I team, now they have that confidence of going into the tournament where they're not awed. They're not awed like, oh, there's no chance of us ever beating a team like that when they beat a team like that months ago. So I think that went a long way as far as their confidence. Do they win the next game? I'd say probably not.
They're playing Florida.
Yeah, I mean, and Florida is a team that obviously just a few years back won back-to-back championships. So it's tough to beat those teams that have a coach who's already been there. He knows exactly what the team needs to do to get to the Final Four and actually win it all. I have a hard time believing they win again.
Yeah, but I can guarantee you this, whether they win or not, I think part of the interest in Florida Gulf Coast is the exciting way they play. I mean, let's be honest, not only do you have a 15 seed making it to the Sweet 16, you have an incredibly exciting team that likes to dunk, already has a swagger, even as a number 15 scene. I think, what are they calling Fort Myers now? Is it Dunk City?
Dunk City.
Yeah,
I love that.
So you got to love that. You got to love, you know, the attitude that they come with. And I was reading some crazy statistics about just what these two wins have done for the profile of the school. I think they said something like sales of team merchandise have at the campus bookstore went up 1,000%.
Oh my God!
After their first weekend of victory,
I'm wearing my Coach Andy Enfield T-shirt as we speak. Okay, fine.
I'm wearing his wife's T-shirt.
Right, before we go, do they beat Florida tonight, Shira Springer?
I say yes, only because that's what I tune into March Madness for. I love the upset. I will always root for the upset.
Me too. How about you, Chris Collins?
I think if you watch tonight's game and you watch a team that is so athletic like they are, but they will find a different notch being Florida. That is a team that really will at least beat them by double digits. They will not understand what it's like to be with a team on the floor from the SEC until they get there, and it'll be a rude awakening. It'll be like Notre Dame. It'll be like Notre Dame,
yeah,
in Alabama. You know, Notre Dame was undefeated, and we're talking football here, but Notre Dame was undefeated, but they had no idea about the speed that comes in the SEC.
That was the national football championship. Yeah. Hey, Shira, you have
double
a final
digits,
thought?
Shira. 10 points.
I think they're going to be far more competitive than Chris thinks, and one of the reasons I think so is no pressure. You know, I think that psychology plays a big role in these situations.
Shira Springer from the Boston Globe, Chris Collins, NECN Sports. It's a pleasure. We'll check your predictions on Monday. Good to see you, Chris. Good to see you, Shira.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. And coming up is our Friday News Quiz with a twist. Our Friday News Quiz is coming up with that twist. All Tom Menino trivia with two guys who just might succeed Tom Menino. We'll have that for you in a minute. This is Boston Public Radio.
Listening to Boston Public Radio. Now, for this week's news quiz, we have a treat, an all Tom Menino quiz. You know, our goal, Marjorie and I met yesterday, our goal was to invite every city councilor who was thinking of running for mayor, but there was no studio big enough at WGBH, so we had to settle for two, city councilor Felix Arroyo and city councilor Tito Jackson. Great to see you both, guys.
Nice to see you, too.
Thanks for having me. Thank you both for coming.
Are you running?
I don't live in Boston, but I'll run anyway. What do I care?
Well, you know, yesterday was, of course, the big day for the mayor, and everybody was very respectful because it was he's going to be around for another 9 months, but it was his day to announce he was not running, so you couldn't say anything yesterday. Today, however, is a different day. You're running, Felix?
Serious consideration into running. I want to have the conversation first with my family. We're all going to get it this weekend, and we're going to talk about it as a family.
Okay,
first.
Can we get your family on the phone right now so we can have that conversation?
How about you, Tito? How about you?
I'm also giving it serious consideration. I will be having a conversation with my family over food.
Wait a second. Can I just ask a question? The obvious question. This mayor election is in the same cycle as the city council elections, right?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
So the potential is that there can be nobody on the city. I mean, this could be one of the biggest turnovers in the city council in American history, no?
And we believe in the future. We actually have a good bench, and we have some great young leaders who would come up. I think that's obviously a consideration that we all have to make.
Do you have to give up your seat to run?
I do. And Jim knows more than most. Yeah. These jobs are supposed to be temporary.
They are.
So running for mayor would mean you would not be on the city council anymore.
It would mean that if we decide to run and if we don't win, you probably won't invite us back on the air.
Believe me, that is correct.
That's what it means.
Tito Jackson may have an early edge because he's got Tito Jackson written on the side of his glasses. I think that's very
He does. That is amazing.
Yes, he does.
Very impressive. Okay, let's get to it.
Hipster over there. Hipster.
You asked the first question of Felix Arroyo Marjorie again.
Okay, Felix, you ready?
Yes.
This is a former Massachusetts state representative and the current president of the New England Council talking in 1988 about his redistricting plan. I'm going to play some sound and you can guess who he is.
What the court is saying is the state is not made up of 351 communities. It's made up of inhabitants, 5,746,440 inhabitants, divided by 160 legislators. That's the districts. Everything else is secondary.
Now, Felix, you might have been in grammar school back when he made this little presentation, but I'm going to ask you anyway, who was that speaking, and what is his significance vis-a-vis Tominino?
This is Dorchester State Representative Jim Brett, and he made the finals in 1993 in Tominino's first run for mayor.
Very
excellent.
Good.
Felix
very
Arroyo.
Good.
Touché.
Yeah, I would never guess. I didn't even have a distinctive voice, does he? I don't think so.
We were with him yesterday.
You were?
At UMass.
For what? What were we doing?
That's right. That's right.
We were at the UMass Chancellor's Awards.
We're asking, what does it look like if you don't win? We were asking him, and he advised that we should win, is what he said.
Okay, Tito Jackson, Jim. Here's your opportunity to tie things up. Here's Tominino, heard along with another big city mayor in an ad that ran last year. Who's the other mayor, and what's the issue they're talking about? And there's a bonus question, too. During what event was this ad seen for the first time? It's a three-parter. Listen up.
You know, over 600 mayors across the country agree on common sense reforms that would save lives.
Add your voice. It's a patriotic thing to do.
You can make a giant difference in our country.
Three-part question. Who's the other mayor? What's the issue? And during what event was the ad first seen? Tito Jackson.
Mayor Bloomberg.
Yes.
And the event?
Yeah, what was the event?
The event, and you can hear it from the background, I would say the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I was right. And what were they talking about?
They were talking about gun control and how we can deal with the issue of assault
weapons. Okay, I'm going to give you a fourth part to the question. Where was Mayor Bloomberg, before he was Mayor Bloomberg, born and raised, Tito Jackson?
Medford, Massachusetts.
Wow. Excellent. Very nicely.
Do I get 4 points?
Yeah, you should get an extra point. That wasn't on the sheet, Jim. You just threw that in there.
No, actually it is on the sheet. We skipped number two. For a serious moment for a second, are you guys being, we talked about this with Callie Crossley earlier today, we're on the verge of getting virtually no gun reform out of Congress. What is it, fewer than 100 days after Newtown? Does it not leave you with a sense, Felix, that if after Newtown they can't do anything, that Congress will never do anything?
Yeah, if not now, then when, right? It is... Maybe disgusting is a strong word, but it is disgusting to hear the arguments that the Republicans' leadership are making as to why we can't have guns.
Well, but be fair. Control. Harry Reid is the Democratic leader in the Senate. He's the one that pulled the assault weapons ban out of the bill that came out of Senator Feinstein's committee.
That's fair. So let me be nonpartisan about it. It's disgusting anybody who doesn't understand the importance of gun control.
And I think this is also where the Governor Patrick's statement that we need to step up and have a backbone is very significant. Not only do those guns destabilize the states that don't have the laws, but they also destabilize our state. And so those guns come across our border on a regular basis.
Sure.
We have the toughest laws in Massachusetts. And remember, there were laws that people put forward that wanted to have one gun a month. And it was this radical thing. Only, you know, although we only have two hands.
Oh, whoa! But sometimes you got to buy two, right? Okay, you want a different color one.
It's not
right.
An
sneakers, right, Marjorie? It depends what color sneakers
right.
you're wearing.
I'm really glad you brought that up. Limiting purchases in the state to one gun a month was considered too radical. It's unbelievable. Okay,
different colored guns, I remember meeting people that were actually looking for pink women that were looking for pink guns so they could have little pink
at the gun show you went to. Up here.
Yeah, so for the gun show. And haven't there been studies about the number of guns coming out of state are huge in Boston? Correct.
Definitely. Humongous. Definitely.
Next question for Felix Arroyo.
Next question. Okay, I am doing number. Okay, this is
begins with what was the mayor talking about?
Thank you very much, Jim. Okay.
That's why I'm here.
What was the mayor talking about, thank you very much, when he made this video spoofing The Godfather?
We've known each other for many years. This is the first time you came to me for advice. You've always gone to the empty suits of the media. I can't remember the last time you invited me for Dunkin' Donuts or a cup of gold or soundwatch.
Commendatore, I ask your friendship.
Thank you.
I look forward to the day when we break cannolis at the Modern Pastry.
Cannolis are nice. But one day, I will also ask you for a favor like providing 10,000 summer youth jobs. I'll put a Hugway bike rack in the lobby of International Palazzo. Now I must go. Leave the blueprint. Take the cannolis.
I love that line.
I want to eat them.
Okay, you know what the mayor was talking about?
Yes, He was talking about the Chiafaro project.
Whoa, Don Chiafaro. You are hot, you two.
And it's on the Greenway. His idea was of putting a large building on the Greenway that the mayor very publicly didn't like.
Yeah, Don Chiafaro and the mayor have had their squabbles. Is it really true that there are potholes deeper than in any part of the city of Boston, right in front of Don Chiafaro's international place? Felix Roy, is that true?
I don't know if that's true, because as an at-large counsel, I'll take some blame there if it is. So I hope it's not true, and if it is, we'll be out there filling them in.
So before I do another question to Tito, were you both at the 4 o'clock thing at Faneuil Hall yesterday?
Yes, we were.
Yes.
You were. Okay, when the mayor said, I could run, I could win, the city councilors were sitting together. Was John Connolly clapping at that particular moment? He was?
Yes.
Out of nervousness, not out of...
No, I think out of the fact that he probably knows that was the case.
Look, we talked about it yesterday, Jim. He has 74% approval rating.
It's unbelievable.
After
20 years.
I told you on another program that you host, the Jim Broad Show, I said, I don't have 74% in my family. Right? And this Easter, I'm probably going to find out if I'm anywhere near 60%. You know? And so, yeah, I think he would have won. I think he was speaking absolute truth. Yeah.
Okay, next question for you, Tito Jackson, to try to tie this up. This is the fight song. You mentioned UMass. For the UMass Minutemen, where Tom Menino earned his BA in community planning in 1988 while a member of the city council. I didn't know that. But can you name the school now closed, where Tom Menino earned his associate's degree in business management in 1963?
Tough.
Listen to the fight song. This is one of the toughest questions. Does this get you in the mood to answer the question? Yeah, I think it does.
Yes, it does.
Tito is moving to this. Okay, enough music. Where did he earn his associate's degree in business management in 1963, Tito Jackson?
It's not Notre Dame. It's Boston State.
That is an excellent guess, but it's also wrong, I should say.
I think it starts with an S, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
I'll give you a hint, both. It starts with a C. Does that help anybody?
No.
Starts with a CH. Does that help anybody?
That's a challenge.
It starts with a CHAM. Does that help anybody?
I'd never even heard of this place.
No, I just like the record. Okay. I was born in 79.
It's Chamberlain Junior College.
Chamberlain.
There's a follow-up question, Tito Jackson. Can you name the college in Newton? This is easier. Which absorbed Chamberlain Junior College in 1988? Go ahead.
LaSalle.
That would also be wrong.
He's
How about
Boston
you, Felix?
City Arroyo?
I don't know what is going on in Newton. No,
yeah, exactly.
We're going to call Seti Warren right now.
Wait, does Newton have colleges?
That's not going to work for you. Thank you. By the way, as Marjorie and I, of course, know, Chamberlain Junior College was absorbed by what school, Marjorie?
Mount Ida.
Give Marjorie the points. That is correct.
I did not know about Chamberlain College or Mount Ida until right now, so there you have it. There it is. Mm-hmm.
Marjorie, take it away.
Okay, Felix. Listen to this sound, and then we're going to have the question.
I've sent a letter to the CEO of the company saying we don't appreciate his views on the issue of gays and said that that's not welcome in the city of Boston.
Tito is very unhappy. This is not his question.
Okay. It's a real difficulty parameter.
Tito's
here.
Happy, but I'm also
going to be the Russian judge on this one.
You did get a hard one, Tito, about the Chamberlain Junior College. Okay, but Felix, here's your question.
But you didn't know Jim Brett.
What CEO was the mayor talking about, and what was the name of that CEO's company?
Oh, well, you have me on half of this because I can't tell you the name of the CEO, but I can tell you that it's Chick-fil-A.
That is correct.
So if Tito knows the name of the CEO, I'll be happy to share points with him.
Do you have any idea?
I do not know the name of although I know he should stick to chicken.
His name is Chamberlain Junior College. That's the
Chamberlain Junior College. And he has been closed, and now he can only do business in Newton.
Dan Cathy is his name, which I didn't remember.
Well, you know,
either.
This reminds me of something that people mentioned yesterday, but it's worth mentioning again. You know, you think of Mayor Menino, you know, kind of Hyde Park kind of guy, Boston raised and all that sort of stuff. You don't think of him as being out front on stuff like condom giveaways, like back in the late 80s and early 90s when gay rights was still sort of, to lots of people, a very scary prospect. He was on the ground floor with all this stuff.
Marjorie, what he deserves a lot of credit for is something that I also do, but frankly, he set the tone, and that is that the St. Patrick's Day Parade, for instance, has the right.
That's right.
Has the right granted to them by the U.S. Supreme Court to not allow LGBT groups to march as an LGBT group. So you can march as long as you don't tell anybody you're gay, I guess, is the rule. And the mayor, the minute that decision was made, as mayor, the minute it was made, he said, then I'm not marching. That he did that in 94, 93.
Yeah.
In 2009, I didn't march. It was my first campaign in 2011. I didn't march 2011. But it is significantly easier, I would say, not to march when the mayor of the city of Boston says, I don't do that.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
And he was, it was so early. You don't think of him, a friend of mine called him an early hipster. I don't know, hipster.
Early hipster?
Early hipster.
Okay.
Well, he is into bicycling, right?
He is into bicycling. He is.
Yeah.
But I think that issue, amongst a lot of other issues that the mayor has actually led on. And I think the issue, I went to the Men of Fenway event the other night. There was a standing ovation with 1,300 people in the room, and he was referred to in his introduction with many other folks in the room, including other mayor hopefuls, as mayor for life.
Really?
And so he, again, has earned his stripes in that community and communities as a whole in terms of bringing this city together in a way that hadn't been done in the past.
Okay, yeah. Tito Jackson, that's the voice of Tito Jackson. Also in the studio is his fellow city councilor, Felix Arroyo, who, Tito, is singing a parody of Ebony and Ivory, and why are they associated with Tom Menino?
Lord, I want this municipality.
I'd say that's more than enough of that, if you know what I mean. That is the worst rendition of Ebony and Ivory I've ever heard. Question again, Tito Jackson, who is singing it and why is that associated? Why are they associated with Tom Menino?
I actually have no idea. My question is why and how did that ever get recorded?
Actually a decent answer. Do you have any idea, Felix Arroyo?
Tag me out. I'm glad you stopped it before people changed the dial, though.
Okay, here's a clue. Okay. It occurred during the 2009 mayoral campaign.
Was that Sam and Michael?
It was Sam and Michael. Sam Yoon and Michael Flaherty. That's right. Give him a half a point.
And Sam Yoon has since left town. I don't know where
he's
he
went.
He's in Washington. He's working for the president.
He's in the White House.
So hold on. Did I get 4 points for the first question? Because you asked me about 13 questions.
What is
the
score, judges, at this point? Can we please have the judges? And while we have the judges, Marjorie, we're skipping 4.5. Who has 4.5? Arroyo's got 4.5, and Tito's got 4, so this is pretty big. Now, here's how we're going to jump to the Menino sports clips, and here's how it's going to work.
Oh, man.
We're going to play one, and then Marjorie is going to, don't answer until she tells you to. Whoever gives the correct answer first gets the points. Is that fair? You understand that, gentlemen?
I don't understand it.
Fine, you don't need to understand it. It's okay. Here it is. You ready? Here is clip number one, and then we'll tell you, the question is, who did Tom Menino mean to be talking about? That's the question. Here's the first clip.
We have an amazing set of remarkable athletes whose action in a moment have become ionic in sports. Havlicek stole the ball, Fisk waving the ball fair, Flutie launched the Hail Mary pass, Veritek splitting the uprights.
Okay, when he said Veritek split the uprights,
Vinatieri.
Vinatieri, that would be Felix Arroyo gets that correctly.
Okay.
Here's the next one.
Okay, whom did he mean when he mispronounced?
Here it comes.
We're going to play it first?
We're going to play it,
play it first.
Will Fork?
Well, you don't get points for that, he said. Let's try another one here. This is going well, I think.
You asked me Chamberlain College.
I did.
Chamberlain Junior,
it's junior
College.
To
oh
you.
My
Thank
goodness.
You. Let's do one more sports one if we can, please. Here it is.
You do these, Jen. This is over my head.
It is over mine, too. Go ahead. Here's another one.
Grabowski, Hernandez, West
Gronkowski.
That is right. When he said gonk, he was actually referring. Okay. Now, in light of the fact that these are not going as well as we expected, we're going to end this, gentlemen, with one. This is a what's the score?
Let's say it's a tie.
Whoever gets this right wins the whole thing. Who does Mayor Menino call? There's no sound for this. Every single morning at the beginning of the day. Who's he call?
John Fish.
That would be wrong. He's the head of Suffolk Construction. He may call him, but that's not the answer. Felix, if you get this right, you win. It could be a good omen for the future.
Right.
If you don't get it
and
right.
And we know for a fact he calls the same person every day.
The same set of people every single morning. Who would they be?
Michael Knievy.
That would be wrong. His chief of staff. And the answer, Marjorie, is?
His grandkids.
That is exactly
who
right.
Who range in age, rather, from 8 to 15.
Wow, that's a nice story,
isn't that
actually.
Sweet?
I didn't
sweet.
Know that.
Yeah,
Felix Arroyo,
nice.
It's been a pleasure. Good
Thanks
luck if you decide
me.
To run. Tito Jackson, the exact same words to you.
Tito, don't feel bad. Jim gave you all the card questions.
We ended in a tie.
Okay. It's Chamberlain Junior College. Repeat after me. Thank you very much.
I can't even apply.
Gentlemen, it's great to see you. Hey, thanks everybody who joined us today. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. On Monday, Reverend Eugene Rivers joins us to tell us who he thinks is the best person to next lead Boston. Will that leader be a person of color? And with the final four set, should college, I actually feel pretty strongly about this, should college basketball players be compensated out of the millions and millions they are making for their schools? And by the way, I really do a shout out. I want to do a shout out to Madison. Thank her for listening. Marjorie is looking at me oddly. She's a young woman. I'll tell you about her a little bit later, Marjorie. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. We hope you're back Monday at noon. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
See you then. Bye.